I'm Omar. I'm a fifth year PhD candidate at Stanford. I'm also an Apple AI ML scholar. I do retrieval and what we call foundation model programs. So these are pipelines of language models. And I actually don't drink coffee. This is the question that Demetrius asked. I love tea. Right.
Welcome back to the ML Ops Community Podcast. I am your host, Demetrios, and we got a doozy today. Oh my God, I love talking to Omar. He is doing some incredible stuff, and I just got the full scoop from him. We stopped recording, and then he told me the whole story about the timeline of his creation, DSP, and then later on, DSPy. And so I'm going to rehash that for you real fast. I think it is quite interesting because he is a researcher, but he is doing DSPy. He is creating DSPy and really looking at retrieval. And that is 100% MLOps. That, in a way, is exactly what we're working on day in, day out. And so it's great to hear his stories and how he looks at things and why he felt like something like DSPy was needed. It is an abstraction layer that is a bit different than other ones that I think you see out on the market that are doing similar things. And so let's talk about this timeline, because he broke it down for me and he said, listen, we started version zero for DSP, which is the precursor to DSPy, in February 2022. So not February 2023 when there was all that ChatGPT buzz going on. It was February 2022. And in February 2022, what he wanted to create was something that was an abstraction layer for pipelines using large language models, namely GPT-3, the precursor, again, to ChatGPT and all the craze. So they put it out there, and then they realized, hey, wait a minute, nobody is really creating pipelines with these large language models, or if they are, it isn't really a pipeline, it's just a straight GPT-3 call, and they're interacting directly with the model, not looking at it as a pipeline in the way that we look at different pipelines these days. And in traditional ML, you would look at pipelines and using different models in different pieces of your pipeline. And so they continued down the road. Nevertheless, they didn't let that discourage them, and they released DSP version 1. And then he realized, you know what? I think this is the wrong abstraction layer. And so they released DSP version 1, but they had to take a long, cold, hard look in the mirror and see if this is really what they were trying to create and if this was as much of a value add as they wanted it to be. And ultimately, they said no. Since they said no, they went back to the drawing board. And the reason that they were having trouble was because the D in DSP, this demonstrate, it was really complex for people to understand. And later in this conversation, you'll hear him talk about how this demonstrate, what he now considers to be compilers, are ways that you can compile these different modules and really like go and do almost this hyperparameter tuning when you're, he makes a lot of analogies with neural nets. And he was talking about how compilers are a way for you to go and you can explore the best way of using these pipelines. But when DSP came out, they were not using the compilers because they were putting it on the user, the end user, to create this demonstrate and these compilers. And they were saying, you need to demonstrate what you're trying to get from us, right? And so people didn't know what the hell was going on. They were confused out of their mind, and DSP wasn't the right abstraction layer. So they went back to the drawing board after version one, and they said, you know what? Instead of this demonstrate, what we're going to do is we are going to be the ones that create the compilers, even though it is open source. And if anyone wants to create their own compiler, they can. But he feels that it is his job to create the compilers. And then the rest, all these modules for the pipelines and all the abstractions, the end user can use and leverage. And so you do not have to think through that complex piece when it comes to the compiler. And they put out DSPy from that. And DSPy came out in August 2023. It feels like it's been out for ages, and it is absolutely killing it. For anyone that has not used it, we're leaving a link in the description. I have fallen in love with this framework. I absolutely think it is fascinating, and especially because some of the key things that he pointed out when I was talking to him, and I literally was holding on to my chair this whole conversation, trying to keep up with the guy. Omar is brilliant, and he was able to bring me on this journey, and I hope he brings you on this journey and doesn't lose you. I had to slow him down at some points just to make sure that I was understanding what he was saying. But really, he talked about being how brittle it is if you're prompt first. And prompt first is like, hey, there's this dark art of prompting. And really, if we're looking at it as like, we're going to somehow find a magic prompt when we're interacting with these LLMs and when we are creating pipelines to go and make LLM calls, that's not the way to be looking at it. And that's what they're actively trying to avoid with DSPy. So the final thing I want to say is that at the end, he talks about fine-tuning and how modules with fine-tuning, or a module in DSPy, can just be a fine-tuning of a model. And wow, he brought a whole new way of looking at data pipelines or ML pipelines, LLM pipelines, whatever you want to call it, to my mind and my view, and I really liked it. I hope you enjoy this. Let's get into the conversation, but first, I gotta get paid, so let's hear a word from our sponsors. All right, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsors, Weights and Biases. It seems like everyone's working on large language models right now, but understanding what to build with LLMs and how they work under the hood can be tricky. Thankfully, Weights and Biases can help. You might know about Weights and Biases' flagship experiment tracking product. In the LLM space, teams like OpenAI and Cohere rely on Weights and Biases to train and debug their models, but Weights and Biases has plenty more to offer you if you're thinking about training, fine-tuning, or prompt engineering an LLM on your own. Weights and Biases Traces lets you uncover granular insights about your LLMs, providing a visual representation of their execution flows, color-coded by each component in the chain. This helps you understand each step your LLM takes on its way to generating its output, giving you a deep, nuanced view of its behaviors and letting you iterate and debug much more quickly. Weights and Biases LLM production monitoring enables the creation of custom dashboards to monitor your LLM activities in real time, including throughput, token usage, cost, latency, and errors. That sounds so good. And if you need help getting started with Weights and Biases, they can help too on that front. They've released multiple free classes for machine learning communities like ours, the MLOps community, teaching them how to build LLM apps intelligently, approaching prompt engineering, and a whole lot more. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just getting started on your LLM journey, you can find what you need at Weights and Biases. You can get started today going to wandb.me/mlops_traces for free today. Get after it. wandb.me/mlops_traces. Let's get back into the podcast. So, I was calling it DSPy, but you said it's not DSPy. What is it?
It's DSPy, like NumPy.
DSPy, like NumPy. Of course, it all makes sense now. And that's why, yeah, there's the capital. And have you ever thought about calling it DSPy?
We did. And the story here is that the first version of the framework was called Demonstrate Search Predict. So that's DSP. And we got too many questions and too many people who thought it's just about digital signal processing. And there's absolutely no relation there. And so in the second version, we wanted a rebrand that nonetheless keeps the, you know, people who are familiar with the original version can relate to this. So DSPy was it.
Then you pivoted, basically. You did the good old pivot and you said, hey, we're going to go with DSPy. I like it. Well, dude, Omar, I'm stoked to have you on here, man. Give me the quick rundown. I know you're doing stuff at Stanford right now, but you've got all kinds of great things happening in your life. I would love to start at how you got into tech.
Well, I started building small software, you know, back home, I guess, as a teenager. And I did CS in undergrad. And what I wanted to do in CS was mostly research-oriented stuff. Basically, I like building systems that have novel components. In undergrad, I did mostly research on sort of optimizing the efficiency of AI applications. And from there, I worked on information retrieval, so making search faster.
But this was before the AI boom, I imagine.
This was before, well, I mean, AI boom, there's many of these cycles, I guess, but certainly before the most recent one. This was, you know, 2016, 2017. And I started doing IR in 2018 from a systems standpoint. And then I joined Stanford for my PhD. And BERT had just come out in NLP. So language models, large language models by some standards were kind of starting to look like they will be the future, and they are the present now. But they weren't really sort of mainstream in search yet. And just around that time, the IR community, the information retrieval community, started looking at BERT for ranking. But it was this sort of artifact that is, you know, 1,000 times more expensive, but a lot better in quality than whatever sort of we had before in search. So I started my PhD thinking about, can we make, you know, language models for search stuff orders of magnitude faster and cheaper while also pushing their quality up? And that was Colbert. And from there, we started looking also at, you know, this is work with my advisors, Matei Zaharia and Chris Potts. We started looking at building these retrieval-based NLP systems. So people talk about RAG all the time now. So that type of thing, building these retrieval-based systems. Especially in cases where the language model actually needs to interact in complex ways with a search engine. And from there, this is where ultimately DSPy came out as a programming framework that generalizes years of our work, you know, into a highly expressive and, you know, powerfully optimizing programming model. So you could build the type of stuff that would take us months before. You know, in minutes or hours, and compile them into really high quality NLP systems.
Wait, so I gotta ask, of course, Colbert, is that a shout out to the good old Stephen Colbert? Was somebody a fan?
Yeah, I mean, it's that is the context of the name. We saw that BERT was all around, and you know, it stands for contextualized late interaction over BERT. And the funny thing here is the paradigm that we introduced is called late interaction. And so it was just right there, you know, late interaction and the late show. Nested jokes there.
Yeah. It just keeps getting better. What did you see as the evolution there? Because as you mentioned, okay, RAGs are all the rage now. But when you were doing it with BERT, what was it? And how has it changed?
Yeah, it hasn't fundamentally changed. I say people are doing the very basic versions of things. That's what got popular. Which you know, over time you realize that's really what happens, is that the basic thing gets popular because it's very easy for people to sort of grasp it. So generally back in like 2019, 2020, and around that, you know, around that time, and really all the way until last year, in fact, the second half of last year, all of the RAG stuff, with very, very few exceptions, were about fine-tuning a retriever and a language model together, usually very small models, such that the language model could condition its generations, or like base its generation on the retrieved passages. What we started seeing last year, and we led a lot of this, is using few-shot prompting as a way to use language models for conditioning on retrieval. And this is what people mean when they say RAG now. Technically, RAG is the name of a method, a great work from Meta AI, that is a very specific way of fine-tuning a generative model with a retriever together. So it's not really what, or at least fine-tuning a generative retriever, conditioned on a fine-tuning a generative model, a language model conditioned on a retriever. And what we did basically April 2022 was, for the natural language understanding course at Stanford, we released this course project as open source. And we widely announced that as, the first open source sort of artifact where you could prompt GPT models and local, I think they were GPT-J models, so that they answer open domain questions through a retrieval. And this is basically, the foundation of a lot of the recent, and popular stuff around RAG. But the whole area of retrieval-based NLP more broadly than RAG has a lot richer pipelines. So the questions there are things like, how do you supervise the retriever so that it solves complex tasks for your generator? Usually, maybe you want to check complex claims, or there are sort of dependencies of knowledge. So, you can't actually find the page you're looking for until you find some other dependencies first. So that's called multi-hop retrieval. And adapting retrievers there is a very significant challenge that is, something we worked on for a while. And this is kind of missing in the recent, developments in open source in general, besides a few key artifacts.
So this is fascinating because it's basically saying like, hey, the RAGs that we know and love today that everybody's talking about and writing about are one style. And maybe not even the style that Meta AI put out back in the day when they wrote about RAGs, but we kind of hijacked that name and we call it one thing, yeah. Which is basically you just like go and look for some information in a vector database before you give a prompt to a large language model. And you're mentioning that's like a very basic method of doing retrieval. What are some other, and you also mentioned how there's much more complicated methods. One of them being you got to get some dependency. So you have to figure out some piece of information before you can move on to the next piece of information. What are some other ways that you've seen or you've been playing around with like super complex retrieval?
Yeah, so there is two sides to my work that I think are going to, add a lot to the sort of application layer developers who are looking at RAG things. So these are research ideas around what we call late interaction. And that is basically at the level of like, how do you model retrieval? And the sort of popular approach that people are familiar with is you encode documents as a vector. So you're producing a dense representation for each document and similarly for the query. And late interaction says it's actually really a significant burden and really hard for these encoders to produce one vector for each document, which might be relatively long, that is supposed to capture every possible query you can ask about that document and nothing else. So late interaction says we should actually be representing documents as a matrix of many small vectors. So a very, very tiny sort of representation at the level of the tokens, not at the level of the document. And if we sort of optimize that well with the right infrastructure, we can get this thing that is as fast and as, efficient as encoding each document with a vector, but that has much higher quality, especially in domains without a lot of training data. I saw a recent paper that was basically saying, if you fine tune Colbert with, I think it was like 1,000 queries, it does as well or better than a single vector representation fine-tuned with 50,000 queries. So there's a 50x sort of data efficiency gap there, according to that recent work. So that's one, I think, direction that people should increasingly pay attention to. And a different line is sort of putting emphasis less on the specific models, language models and retrieval models in general, and more emphasis on your program, so on your pipeline. We like to draw an analogy to neural networks. When you're building, we've all sort of now come around to, see transformers as sort of this architecture that works in general and works really well. But for the longest time, people were just exploring all these feed-forward neural networks, where you're composing a lot of layers together. Maybe you have like convolution layers, you have recurrent layers, you have, you know, linear layers, and then you have all these transformations like dropouts and other activation functions and all that stuff. And clearly the power there in general is not in finding like one really great layer or optimizing the parameters of a great layer. It's about, you know, the depth and composing a network out of these modular pieces. And what we're saying is that increasingly in language model land, it's not about using GPT-4 or like the right or fine tuning with the right RLHF or whatever it is. It's really about building the right architecture for your target task and application, and maybe down the line, a general purpose one. And so that is where things like multi-hop interactions come in. So the idea is we'd like to basically be able to build these higher level architectures where language models are simply devices that can execute these instructions, where the focus is not on like prompting the model as carefully as possible with, you know, with magical nuance or fine tuning it in, you know, the exact right way. It's really about breaking down problems so that, you know, this powerful contextual, you know, processor that we have can make sense of complex tasks. And that's where something like DSPy comes in. It gives you a programming model for programming these language models into pipelines.
Dude, a lot to take in here. And of course, I was stuck when you were talking about, I was expecting you to have some word for the ragiverse or something that you were going to say. These rags that we come on, and that's kind of the way that we're looking at rags these days is through this one encoding the whole document as a vector as opposed to this matrices that you're talking about. And so there, let's just harp on that point real fast. You're not saying that, okay, vector databases aren't going to be needed. You're saying that the way that we create the vectors and then throw them into the database can be fundamentally looked at in a different style.
Right. That's exactly right. So you still need some infrastructure to do the search. Right now, Colbert is an open source project that has that infrastructure. We've written a lot of papers on making it really efficient. You know, both in terms of latency and storage costs and otherwise. But this is, you know, much of that is actually integrated in a vector database called Vespa. I believe, you know, they are also open source and they have offerings that are commercial. And, you know, maybe you can expect more in the future. In general, though, this is, this is a fundamental redesign of the search stack, but at the same time, from an end user standpoint, it's a black box. So it's the same behavior. You're sending search queries, you're getting back results, but the encoding of these documents is redesigned in such a way that our encoders, our language models, get to focus on representing documents contextually as opposed to doing this combinatorial process of just trying to find representations in one fixed embedding space for, you know, entire documents.
Yeah, which ultimately leaves a better end user experience because they're going to be getting more relevant retrieved information and faster, if I'm understanding correctly.
It's not faster, but it's about as fast. It is the quality though that can be a lot better, especially in harder domains and domains with little data.
No, okay. Okay, cool. And I gotta ask before we move on to the next point, around this system, because this ML hub or the hub that you spoke about is incredible too. With BERT, what is the reason for using BERT as opposed to now there's been a ton of new open source large language models that come out? Have you thought about trying to do stuff with those, or is it that BERT is the right size and the right model because of the way that it performs? It's good, it works, it's smallish.
So it depends which part you're asking about. If you're talking about like building pipelines of language models, BERT can't really take you far there. But if you're talking about modeling retrieval, So for example, if you're talking about DSPy, yeah, you got to use, you know, Llama 2 or, you know, Mistral or GPT models. If you're talking about modeling search, and in particular encoding documents for retrieval, up until now, BERT is both BERT-like models. I don't mean the actual original BERT. Are still both the right size and the right pre-training and the right architecture combination. There has been some cool recent work that looks at like using Llama 2 models for this. I'm not impressed yet.
Wait, why not?
Well, because people release their artifacts and you can play with them and sort of see what's the trade-off. And so you have these models that are, I don't know, is that like 700 or whatever, 70 times bigger. But they are like 2 points better on some benchmarks. And so retrieval is a special problem because the emphasis is really on scale. Like, you can throw all the kitchen sink at your problem and maybe get one extra point of quality in some cases. But the real deal is in things that could process, you know, millions of queries over millions of documents in like 10 milliseconds or 20 milliseconds, because you have a lot of concurrent users, you have a lot of documents. And so, it's not the sort of thing like for, reading the documents where you can read, 10 or 20 documents and get really great results. So it's a fundamentally different game. That said, I do expect that we will see, more GPT-style models entering the core, encoding and retrieval part of IR with higher quality fairly soon. And what that will spur is people who will start to think like, hey, how can we actually make that efficient, which is that cycle, that we see a lot in ML, but especially in IR. That said, I think my bigger message is the specific model you're using for language modeling and to a large extent for retrieval isn't actually the key focus going forward. You still want to use the best components. And, we build a lot of the retrieval side there, so we'd like people to use it. But fundamentally, it's really about how you bring these things together. And so, for example, you might have a limited retriever, but what a lot of the research is showing is that if you generate good queries for a fairly limited retriever, you could get around a lot of these limitations. And while you don't want to use a limited retriever, the bigger picture here is it's not about the representations. It's really about getting the right workflow. So if you're trying to maybe fact check a complex claim, you shouldn't expect this, magical vector that can take any string you have and just find all the right sources for you without any additional intent. You really should expect this pipeline that breaks this thing down, runs multiple queries, aggregates the results, compares the documents, and focusing on optimizing the quality of that sort of thing is what I've been doing for the last, year and a half or so.
Dude, so again, it comes back to looking at it as a system, looking at it as a whole, and this is a perfect segue into that second part of this hub. Break that down more. Like, what does that look like? You kind of led us in, you did a little foreshadowing right there, right? Where you said, okay, if you're trying to fact check something, you might want to look at the pipeline this way. What are some other ways that you've seen pipelines being built so that they are more resilient and more reliable and just more able to do what we want them to do?
Awesome. So maybe this is a good place for a little bigger context. So what we've seen over the last, maybe 7 or 8 years or whatever, is that you want to start with a pre-trained language model and then adapt it to whatever task you want to do. And adaptation for the longest time has been through fine-tuning, which is this data-intensive, complex process that needs a lot of expertise and is fragile in slow ways. Then prompting came along, right? So that's maybe 3 years old and, especially in the general form. And it really only started properly working like 2 years ago. So what we started seeing in 2022, especially, and increasingly now, is this notion of prompting techniques. So people have been, researchers and practitioners and everyone interested in the space have been proposing these sort of like conceptual ways of inducing behavior from language models by talking to them in the right way. And so chain of thought is one, building agents, React and self-refine and all these cool things. Retrieval augmented generation through prompting is another here in this space. But increasingly, I think people are coming to the very correct realization that can only take you so far, because the language models don't actually know everything. It's not about talking to them in the right way. It's a very fragile process. So increasingly, what you want is to prompt models in the right way and stack them in the right way. So we're seeing things like if you want to generate SQL queries from your model, you don't just want to ask it with a nice prompt. You probably want to structure this into a process, and we're seeing research in that, you know, in that space that will, you know, handle different types of queries differently, or will actually look at the schema and like the, you know, the parts of the database that you have, you know, and the columns that you have more carefully before it generates queries. And maybe it could, you know, generate stuff and revise them or other things like that. We're seeing tons of this when it comes to retrieval. Lots of pipelines that sort of generate queries, edit them, find citations and all that stuff. So with these pipelines in the wild, what you actually see is that to implement them, researchers and open source solutions alike, what people do is they write strings. They sit down and they open a Python file or whatever, JSON file, and they start writing these kind of handcrafted prompts. They don't work. They edit them a little bit until it starts working for their favorite model. And then they connect these pieces. They chain them to build these pipelines. And that is bad. You know, that's bad for many reasons. First of all, it's super brittle. The language model changes under the hood. You get harder questions or different questions. The domain changes. Someone was working in a general domain that wants to do biomedical stuff. Your prompts don't work anymore. So it's super brittle. But more importantly, it's also unscalable. So, you know, every time you want to change this pipeline, are you going to rechange? You know, are you going to edit all your prompts? And that's especially important in pipelines, because if you are, you know, if you have like three or four stages of calling the language model, you know, this third stage doesn't have any labels inherently. It's just trying to connect the pieces. And so if the other, you know, if the pieces around it change, there's no guarantee that whatever prompt you wrote initially is actually going to be the correct glue in between. So this is super brittle. And our solution to that is sort of keeping the focus on building these architectures and building these pipelines, but shifting it from kind of a hand-tuning game of open-ended free-form prompts to a more structured and automatically optimizable view of the world where, you know, we give you modules, and these modules are going to represent, you know, all of the conceptually clean prompting techniques that are out there, but they're actually well-defined functions that have, you know, these parameters that can be optimized automatically. And so you can say, I want a chain of thought module that has the following signature. Maybe the signature is it should take a question and some paragraphs and give me an answer, for example. And that's all you specify. And then you can reuse that in your pipeline as many times as you want, you know, in loops or in complex control flow. And once you're done, you can give it your data and say like, all right, please optimize my pipeline for my data, given my language model under the following constraints. And that's something we know how to do automatically, as opposed to, you know, just leaving that to the developer who now has to write all these strings. So it's just a significant step forward, I think, from writing prompts as the main way in which we build these systems, which I think is just a really bad idea.
Yeah, it's not prompt first. It's really workflow. And again, coming back to the system first and thinking about it holistically, I'm going to just keep repeating myself because I like the way that you think about it. And I see the pain every day in the MLOps community when people are talking about how brittle those workflows are. And so that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to talk to you. And you did gloss over something, though, that I want to go over, and it's about stacking. Can you explain this idea of stacking more?
Yeah, so the general idea here, people call it stacking, chaining, networks, programs, but it's fundamentally the same thing. It's that you have this language model, and for the longest time, we thought of language models in NLP, including fine-tuned ones, as like these task-specific transformers. But now you can think of them as these devices that you can program. And so instead of thinking, I have a language model that I could use as a chatbot and I can ask it questions, you really want to think of it as like, Well, I'd like to write a program. I'd like to build a system that solves my task or solves my problem. What are the little sort of primitives that, you know, I'd like this model to softly implement? And the really unique thing here is that for a lot of things that are fuzzy, for a lot of computations that are fuzzy, you know, you don't want to work with strings and integers. You want to work with questions and answers and passages and queries. And SQL queries, and as opposed to, I don't know, JSON output and all these sorts of like things where there is some, you know, limited hard constraints on them, like JSON, valid JSON versus invalid JSON is a pretty hard constraint. But fundamentally, though, it is fairly fuzzy. Like, what is the right JSON to have? That's not a thing you could just easily automate the check of. And so stacking language models into fairly complex pipelines, basically arbitrary code, you know, maybe recursion or loops or whatever, but where language models are responsible for these fuzzy computations. That is the world that we're moving towards increasingly. And our sort of big message is, yes, we should move there, but that shouldn't be done through prompting. It should be done through a programming model that sort of codifies and standardizes the way we interact with these things such that we can automatically compile them or optimize them.
Yeah, so if I'm understanding this correctly, really it's like trying to change the chip in my mind or anyone's mind who's listening as to, hey, we're not just going to hit GPT-4 and expect it to do everything because we magically came up with the perfect prompt that solves all our problems. We need to look at how we are going to be trying to almost constrain these different large language models to where they are doing the one thing that we're trying to get done. And like you said, it's the building blocks that we can stack on top of each other. Am I getting that right, first off? And next, I guess I'll ask you a question just to make sure I'm clarifying that. And
yeah, you're exactly right. So the focus now is like, what is the workflow? What is the code that can solve this problem? And which are the little hard parts that I actually couldn't just easily write myself in Python? And how do, you know, what is the right signature there? And what is the right module to ask a model to do that? But the focus is on your entire workflow. So this could, you know, be just Python or, I don't know, TypeScript or whatever it is. And the language model is just handling these relatively well-defined or much better defined now pieces in that bigger workflow.
So you're not going and saying to the language model, hey, do XYZ and expecting the AutoGPT to bake you a carrot cake because it says, okay, well, first I'm going to buy carrots and then I'm going to get them ordered to your house and then I'm going to have the robot machine cut the carrots and put it into with some flour and stuff. It's realizing that large language models have a function that you can give them, and they are really good at playing with, as you mentioned, fuzzy things that aren't so clear and aren't as well defined as something that you could just code with Python or any other language. And so the more that you're able to just plug it in to your pipeline and recognize that we're only going to have it do this one thing and that's all we want, and then we move on to the pipeline, and maybe the next step in the pipeline is something that's just hard-coded and there's no machine learning or AI or anything involved in it. And then the next step in the pipeline might be a new set of large language model calls that you're doing. And so you get to construct that because you're the architect of that pipeline. And my one thing is that automatically comes up is how it seems like we could get a really expensive bill coming in because we start to really like I don't know how to say that word, but we could make a lot of calls to large language models and then recognize like, oh man, I have to be smart about how I'm using these large language models calls because it's starting to get expensive. Have you seen that? Like, have you recognized like, oh yeah, well now that I've got this pipeline, I could do anything, and then next thing you know, in one pipeline, you're making like 20 calls.
Yeah, of course. This is something that this is a central concern that we tackle. So the key observation here to keep in mind is that when you're building these pipelines, There's two dimensions to this. The first is pipelines inherently require a lot less complexity from the language model. When you're breaking things down, the individual steps, you almost never need GPT-4 for the full pipeline. There's at most, in a typical pipeline, there's at most one call that actually needs to go to a really powerful language model. And that's because most of the steps are, hey, let's break this thing down, or like, let's put these things together. And that's not that hard. The second thing, which is a lot more important, is that these pipelines are optimizable. So when you say, I want a chain of thought module in DSPy, what that means under the hood is, I want this thing to actually teach my language model how to solve this step of my pipeline by thinking step by step. So this is not like, it's not like inserting in the prompt, let's think step by step. It's actually, hey, can it internally come up with a few short examples that show whatever model it is, how to think step by step for my task. So that could be by few short prompting, or it could be through fine tuning. And that's all done internally in the programming model in DSPy. And so what actually happens is when you're compiling programs like this, you can make them really small in terms of the models they use. Like we can go like to FLAN T5 large, for example, which has 700 million parameters, million, not billion, right? So you're going to things that are, you know, maybe 1,000-fold smaller than GPT-4 or even smaller. And because they're working at the granularity of like, I want to solve this one step, not like this overarching task. And because they're sort of compiled on your data with your model automatically, you can actually get pipelines that are a lot cheaper than calling a model. And this is, you know, this is where this really ends up connecting all of these pieces.
Dude, well, we've got to go into what I brought you on here to talk about, DSPy, or DSPy as you like to call it. I'm going to call it DSPy because that's what I had cool in my mind before you showed up. But the give us the breakdown. I mean, you've showed a little bit of it, but now like open the kimono. What exactly is it? There are these modules, and modules I'm kind of thinking of as templates that we can use as a nice starting point, and then we can tweak those. Is that how we should look at them, or should it be a little bit different?
I think it's a little different. So let me tell you the way things are done now and what people mean outside of DSPy when they talk about modules, just for context. And this is probably familiar to many in the audience. So if you go to another library for building with language models, they'll have modules. But these modules are going to be things like the module that generates queries for SQLite. And there's a different one that generates queries for MySQL, for example. There's a module that does self-ask. There's a mod, which is a particular kind of workflow for working with search engines. There's a module that does, a particular type of RAG. In DSPy, that's not the granularity of the modules that we have. And the reason for that is if you go and look at these modules in, you know, the libraries that provide this type of thing, that's basically a wrapper around the prompt or two, and then some kind of tool use that allows, you know, the language model that they built this, you know, around to conduct that particular pipeline. And so it's really helpful if you just want something off the shelf that you can stack with, you know, other pieces. But if you want to build your own workflow and have a lot of control over it, it's not actually that helpful because you will have to open it up, start changing that prompt the moment things go slightly wrong. In DSPy, our focus is on finding the right modules and the right primitives that are task independent and in fact task adaptive. One way to think of this is how the neural network sort of development process and how frameworks around that have sort of developed. We take them for granted now, but you know, this stuff actually took a while to reach a consensus. So the idea here is I don't want my modules to be, oh, here is a pre-trained ResNet and here is a pre-trained, you know, BERT. I want my modules to be, here is a layer that I can reuse and train for each task differently. So in our case, for example, prompting techniques are modules. And so if you want to do a chain of thought, that's a module. If you want to do a program of thought, that's a module. And that is not a task-specific thing. A program of thought module just says, I want the model to solve a particular subtask by generating code and executing that code and then interpreting the output of that code. That's a very general process. And the way it works in DSPy is that you are going to declare whatever modules you're going to use. So there's a bunch of built-in ones. You can easily add new ones by using existing modules to build bigger modules. And these modules what makes them really general is that they take this thing called the signature. So a signature is just a specification of the input-output behavior. You can think of it as a prompt that is not written in around hundreds of words, but is written around, you know, 3 or 4 words. And so that's basically a function signature that says something like, all right, for this module, what I wanted to do is to take a long document and give me a summary. Or, and that's literally it, like long document summary. Or it takes a question and maybe some paragraphs and gives me a response. Or whatever, you know, takes an English thing and gives me its German translation. And this is just trying to specify the input-output behavior there because you want to be able to interact with this thing as a function. So just as with a normal function signature, you might say, I should give you a list and you give me a string. That's the type of signature that we have here, except that the types themselves are specified in natural language. Once you've done that and you give that to the module, you have this function that the module gives you that you can call. So if you call the module that's, you know, a chain of thought that answers questions, you know, you give it a question, internally it does a chain of thought, so it thinks step by step, and it gives you an answer. And by declaring several of these modules, you can start writing your code in any way you like. You could have, like, you know, recursion and loops and exceptions where you are calling these modules in the right places of your code, and they're acting as these sort of, you know, language model computation devices you can call at the appropriate places, and that gives you a program. Now, the third and the last and the key thing in DSPy that makes all of this work is that once you've written your program, you can compile it. And compiling it means, hey, I have, you know, I'm actually working in some context, so there's some data I want to work with, or I want to process, you know, my internal database or whatever it is. And what the compiler is going to do is it's going to say, oh, you have three modules. Like, you have this chain of thought module, you have this program of thought module, whatever. You have this other agent that's right there, and you're using them in this pipeline on this data. Each of these modules has some parameters that I can optimize. So in particular, each of these modules is actually sending a prompt or two to a language model. That prompt or two is not something we wrote. Like, if you open DSPy, there isn't a single prompt in the code base. These prompts are going to be generated. It's through an algorithmic process that is going to call the language model on your pipeline, like execute your pipeline on your data several times, potentially with high temperature, and it will keep track of successful traces through each module. So every time it goes through a module, it sees, oh, when I called it with these inputs, I got these outputs, and ultimately, it passed all the constraints, you know, I had a metric that I wanted to maximize, and that it raised my score. It will cache those, and it will basically be able to reuse it later after compilation in such a way that the whole pipeline, maximizes its metric. So basically, we've taken this prompting technique that is right now an idea that you can sort of sit down and type as a string, and we've said, well, what are the parameters of this idea? Well, there are a few shot examples. No one is going to give us those, but we can generate them through the pipeline itself, so we can bootstrap them, and maybe some instructions and other pieces. And we've converted into, like, okay, how can we optimize these pieces automatically so that you're just focused on, I want to use this module with this signature in this workflow, and you just compile it with your favorite data and language model without sort of hand engineering, like, data labels for all these stages or prompts for all these stages, etc. And what that gives you is that compiling takes the same workflow that you wrote and can actually map it to fundamentally different and powerful things. For example, the same code that you write could be a zero-shot prompt to GPT-4 because you want to keep the prompts short, or a few-shot prompt to Llama 2 that has, like, several examples and is very careful about how to optimize that so that Llama 2 understands your task, or a fine tune of local language models that are small, like FLAN T5 that is under a billion parameters in size. And it's the same code because fundamentally you're just saying, I want a module that asks this language model to solve the task that has the following structure by thinking step by step. So the key thing here is that with an abstraction like this, these modules are highly declarative. And so when I say I want a chain of thought module that is going to take maybe a document and give me a summary through thinking step by step, as far as the compiler is concerned, you are free to specify that you want to do this by compiling into a short zero-shot or one-shot prompt for GPT-4 because you want to keep the prompts short because it's expensive, or a long few-shot prompt for Llama 2, for example, you know, 7 billion because that's, you know, cheaper, but also you want to give it a complex enough prompt that shows it exactly what you want. Or by fine-tuning a small model, like a model with hundreds of millions of parameters, not billions, so that it follows that task. And I think this is something that really, you know, surprises people a lot and is a key, you know, strength in DSPy, is that there's no difference between prompting and fine-tuning when you're not doing either. You're just saying, I want this module that has these pieces, and I want to interact with the language model, you know, at these intersections of my code to solve the following subtask. Doing that through prompting or fine-tuning is almost equivalent at that point when you leave it to a compiler. Because in both cases, what the compiler is going to do is it's going to simulate your pipeline on a lot of examples and is going to keep track of input and output behavior of each module, and in particular cases that are actually effective. And with that, you could either fine-tune the model on those inputs and outputs or prompt it with them, or you could even do like learning based on, you know, preferences. You could say like, hey, this output is better than that one. We're not doing this at the moment, this last one, but it's a very easy extension. So it is basically an abstraction that takes us to a different way of thinking about interacting with language models.
So this compiler idea is fascinating to me because it reminds me of basically how you get to a point in time and then boom, there's infinite options almost. I mean, not infinite, but you get many different options where it explores what is the best route here. Let's just go and really explore our options and change the temperature, change all the, turning all these knobs, and then you see which ones are coming out and which ones are to the liking of the end user, I guess, or is it to the liking of the actual model?
So these ideas are sort of all subsumed here, but the way in which we make it, I think this is also a key contribution, the way in which we make this whole thing tractable is by analogy to neural networks. So when you have a neural network, it has, you know, a gazillion parameters. You don't generally sit down and think, it's not even tractable to sit down and think, what should I set all of the weights to today, right? You say, well, what is my loss function? What am I trying to optimize this network for? You say, what is the architecture? Like, okay, I got to decide the layers and how large they are, for example. And you also say, what is my optimizer? So different optimizers can have fundamentally different behavior. Like they want to do basic SGD, they want to add some momentum or atom or whatever. So the same thing is the message we're, you know, pushing here. You are going to decide your workflow or your program. No one is going to, you know, that's not automated. You still need to decide that code, but it's going to be like 15 lines of code, 20 lines of code. And then you are going to have to decide, what are you optimizing? Like, what are you optimizing for? So you need a metric, you know, I mean, are you trying to get the answers to be correct? What does it mean for the answers to be correct? That itself could be a different DSPy program that you just use off the shelf or that you write yourself that determines that process. And now that you have a program and a metric, you need to pick the right optimizer from what we provide, or you could write a new one if you want. And the combination of these three pieces over your data and your language model is going to hill climb in the right way. So for example, one particular optimizer, we call these teleprompters because they do prompting at a distance. So one particular teleprompter is called Bootstrap Few Shot with Optuna. So what that's going to do is it's going to simulate your pipeline on, you know, a bunch of inputs, and then it's going to keep track of the full traces through all the modules whenever the metric, your metric, likes the output. So likes the output could mean, hey, the answers are right. Or it could mean, I actually don't have labels at all, but the answers fulfill the following criteria as tested by another DSPy program. When it finds those outputs, it'll basically cache them, and then it will go back in the pipeline and say, oh, what if I used one or more of these as few shot examples in each of the modules? Does the average score go up now as far as my metric is concerned? And that is an automatic optimization process. In fact, it's like a hyperparameter search that an off-the-shelf thing like Optuna in this case could run, a sophisticated sort of discrete search algorithm under the hood that, you know, can optimize this process. But there's a lot of other teleprompters that are already there or things that we're adding. So, you know, there are teleprompters that are based on fine-tuning. So you're not trying to update the few-shot examples. You're actually trying to update update the weights of a smaller language model in order to conduct each of these steps that are modules. And The idea is not that your first attempt will be this perfect program that is infallible. It's really more like we give you the way to iterate, right? So you build this program, you test it prompting. It works well, but it's too expensive. Try fine-tuning. It works well in most cases, but it's making a consistent type of mistake. Well, you have two well-defined options, or at least better-defined options. Do you want to add an exception in your code that deals with that edge case, or do you want to add, do you want to change the module that you're using here to a more resilient module, or do you want to change the metric so it catches those errors and optimizes them away? Right now, I think what is happening in practice is a lot less structured than this, is that, oh, I'm seeing a mistake. Maybe if I edit this prompt in just the right way, or wait for the next update to GPT-4, maybe things will be better. Or if I get the bigger, pay for the bigger model, maybe it'll just solve my problem. And we're saying, you know, you actually have a lot of options and we can structure them.
It's so funny because earlier this week, I was thinking about how fine tuning, I think it's thrown around a lot by people because it's like as a last resort, it's like, damn, my rag isn't working. And so it must mean that I have to fine tune this. And then maybe what I want to happen will happen, you know, and hopefully a lot of people out there, that's not the case. But I do feel like I've seen that enough to where it's like, people are scratching their heads and they're trying to do exactly what you're talking about, where they're using a framework and they're saying, I guess I gotta like tweak this prompt, or I guess like they're trying to debug why it's not actually coming out with what needs to come out or what they're hoping for. And it's really not as granular as you're talking about. And it's really kind of just like throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Right. And I think a lot of that spirit is needed, like that debugging mindset is good, but you want to have some structure to it. And I think your example on fine-tuning is great, because maybe fine-tuning is the answer for you, but do you really want to work in an abstraction where fine-tuning is a complete revamp of everything you've done, and where you throw it away and you start from scratch to build this fine-tune that may or may not even work? Or do you want to work in an abstraction where, oh, it's just the same code, just flip out the teleprompter from the one that's doing few-shot learning to the one that's doing fine-tuning and test it out? I mean, maybe it doesn't work right away, but it didn't cost you anything and in terms of complexity. And maybe, you know, what you want to do is a different teleprompter that does a different type of fine-tuning. And so adding structure into this space and thinking about it as an optimization problem helps a lot with the problems that you just brought up.
Dude, it's funny because I was on a podcast a while back too, and I was talking about how fine-tuning is a lot more of a headache than most people think, and it is something that you probably don't need, because just with the normal, and what I understand now is a simple rag, it's usually good enough. And it's like, you can go really far with a simple rag, right? You can get it really far, but then people, again, like to think that, oh, I got to fine-tune this, and I want to figure that out, and so, like, I just need to throw some data at it, but people don't think about how much work goes into, A, like, gathering the data and cleaning the data and getting all that data, like, preparing it for the fine-tuning, and then the cost of actually, like, fine-tuning it, right? And so in one way, potentially our minds have been tainted because we had Stable Diffusion before we had fine-tuning on LLMs, and we were like, oh, fine-tuning Stable Diffusion is just like a Google collab, you know? Like, I can throw a few photos of myself in there, and then boom, I prompt it with my name, and I've got this incredibly fine-tuned text-to-image model, and it works pretty well. But then when you try and do that same fine tuning on a large language model, it's not exactly a one-to-one comparison at all, right? But what you're talking about here, I think is fascinating, because I love the idea of how you want to make sure that fine tuning in DSPy does not allow you to forget about anything that you've already created. In fact, it's a way to augment what you've already created so that you're able to say, okay, well, it's not really working with my rag. I've tried all these different things. I've tweaked it. I feel like I could get there. But as that next step, you say, I'm going to try and fine tune it and see if that works. And you do understand it's a much more modular way of looking at a whole system. as opposed to going in and trying to figure out if that prompt that's been hard-coded needs a little tweaking, and then if it does get tweaked and you figure out, you have to dig through documentation after documentation to find that prompt that is at the bottom of, it's the needle in a haystack, and then you say, okay, well, you know what? Now I can tweak that prompt, and then it doesn't actually come out better.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think to your point about the hard-coded prompt, people are doing a lot of hard-coded fine-tunes too, and that's also bad. When you're fine-tuning in DSpy, and this is just a general message, even if someone doesn't use DSpy, at the end of the day, the key artifact you're producing is your system. Your system might use one or more fine-tuned models. These models are not your system. They're just sort of processing parts of the kind of components or the modules in your system. So when you're fine-tuning in DSpy, it's actually, you're not fine-tuning the program. The program is still there. It's just that every time it's going to call a language model, it's going to call an appropriately fine-tuned language model. So that's an important kind of shift from the way, you know, in general, as you've said, people are thinking about these fine-tunes as these kind of end-to-end solutions, which they're not.
Yeah, well, I love the versatility on this too, how you don't get trapped into one workflow for one model for one use case. It's really generalizable in that way. And speaking of generalizable things, I think I would be remiss to not ask your opinion on agents and how your experience with them have been and what you've been up to in that realm, because it feels like this very much is to help move the ball forward in that space.
I think agents are a good idea. And if they were great, I would have said great. Agents are workflows. They are just, you know, programs like any other, except that they usually have a loop, and they sort of, their modules are making decisions about calling tools. So they're just like any other type of program. And so, you know, we've written agents in DSpy. You can compile agents in DSpy because they're just programs. The thing about agents is that it's kind of like this is an analogy, so hopefully people can sort of follow along. It's kind of like we just discovered neural networks, and the first thing we wanted to build is the right transformer architecture. But we have no clue what convolutions are, what attention is, what anything is. We're just kind of jumping right away to build the GPT of neural networks, but in the land of language models. Meaning, agents are this general purpose architecture that, you know, is supposed to be able to solve all kinds of tasks in a general purpose way. But as a community, we still actually haven't fully figured out how to solve individual well-defined tasks first. Jumping into agents at this point is someone needs to explore. I'm not against exploration at all. But from a deployment standpoint, 90% of things that that people are doing don't need agents and are going to get better performance if they don't use agents. That said, I'm all for exploratory science and research and just development in general. And agents are just programs. They're just workflows that you can compile. So if you're going to build an agent, don't write the prompts. Select your modules, connect them in the right way, and compile appropriately. You might get a fine-tuned model. You might get a sort of sequence of prompts that optimizes your agents for the actual goals that you care about. Now, one thing that this will make clear is for some cases, a lot of the exploratory research or just discussion around this is so open-ended that it's not actually trying to optimize for any metric. So if you want to build this agent that could do everything, I think a programming abstraction like DSpy at least makes it very clear what you are optimizing for, or if you're not really optimizing for anything in particular, at least that's a decision that you'd have to be making, which I think is still valuable as an exploratory thing, but maybe not really for deployment.
I love this conversation that we've been having. I love that you came on here and you talked to me about all of this and you explained DSpy in a way that was very understandable for my thick skull, right? And I appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. It was great chatting about this with you.
Last question I got for you is, if you weren't doing the work that you're doing now, where would you be focusing your time and energy? And I'm mainly thinking about in the AI sphere. Like, if you weren't working on DSpy, or retrieval, right? Where would you be looking?
Yeah, so my time is spent 50-50 between these two. If I wasn't doing DSpy, I would definitely go all in on building better retrieval models. If I'm not doing either, I know what I will not be doing. What I will not be doing is trying to build better language models, because I think it's all in the system architecture. But yeah, if I'm not doing DSPy, I'd be releasing Colbert V3 sooner rather than later.
Incredible. And there's no plan right now, I mean, to go and make a run at it with DSPy and create some company around it?
No, there are no such plans. This is open source research. We definitely want to keep it around. We're looking at this as like the PyTorch of this new language model space. And so we want to support all kinds of innovative abstractions and research and development. And we certainly want to keep this around for, 8 years, but no commercialization plans.
Incredible. Well, Omar, man, thank you for coming on here. We'll end it there, dude.
Yeah, thanks a lot.